Okay, having your Bibles with you, would you turn with me, please, tonight to 2 Samuel chapter 15? Make some screen adjustments here so I can see part of the Zoom screen and make sure I have a picture and a audio. 2 Samuel chapter 15. You know, we've gone through a few chapters of some pretty tragic events in David's life ever since he should have been out slaughtering the enemy in the spring like they usually do. Instead, he stayed home and spied his neighbor's wife and decided to take her and then killed her husband and his baby died and all kinds of stuff like that with Bathsheba and Uriah. Pretty tragic story. And then the whole story last week of how the last couple of weeks, Absalom killing his brother Amnon for raping Absalom's sister, which was his stepsister, and the whole dysfunction of David's family because of the multitude of wives, concubines that he had, and his lack of self-control in that area of his life. And we pointed out that, you know, when both Moses and Samuel were telling the Israelis what would happen if they got a king, there was regulations for the king, and it provided that they would not amass wealth and they would not have lots of horses and chariots that would cause them to trust in their battle equipment rather than in the Lord. They were not to have a multitude of wives. One was enough. And yet, David and Solomon and most of the kings after them violated all of those principles that God had set down. And so what we see here going on to the end of 2 Samuel is just the tragic story that comes about in not only David's life, but all of his kids and wives and the whole nation, because of they walked away from the principles of God. And when they do that, the population has a tendency to follow them in a monarchy, and particularly like this, because it's always easier to do the wrong thing than the right thing. And so once they begin down that path, it's pretty difficult to come back. And I remember, you know, a lesson that my dad had taught me about laying tile. And, you know, I was getting upset. I thought, Dad, it's like 3/32 of an inch. What does it matter? And he says, well, it's 3/32 of an inch here, but when you get 70 feet over there, it's going to be quite a ways, hard to patch. And I put my fingers, you know, I look at those, the tips of those two fingers. And if my fingers were 3 feet long, that'd be a pretty good gap at the end of 3 feet. It's hard to bring it back. And it's the same way on our life. If we start down the wrong road, even though it looks like a parallel road, but if it's a few degrees off, you know, a year later, it's pretty hard to come back to where we should be. And
Lost on the Mesa because of that,
got lost on the Mesa because of that.
because they were parallel roads, but then one turned and the other didn't.
Yeah, and pretty quick, you're pretty hard to come back. And so this is what we're witnessing in David's life. And you know, you think, well, what does the Old Testament have to do with today? Well, you know, take a look at where you are in your life. Are you so far astray that it's hard to come back? Then, you know, be careful which road you choose to begin with, and make certain that we're staying true. So when we come into 2 Samuel 15, and this whole story goes through about chapter 19 or so, it's Absalom's conspiracy and his attempt to take the kingdom away from his father. One of the things you want to keep in mind as we go through here, and I'll mention it if I remember, is that remember David is housing Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, when a few weeks ago as we were looking, he said, is there anybody left of Saul's family or Jonathan's family that I can show mercy to? And so Mephibosheth, who's crippled, was brought to the palace and he's living there. But in this revolt of Absalom against David, it appears that at least for a little bit, Mephibosheth sees an opportunity to maybe take back the kingdom to Saul's line instead of David's. And so you have a couple of different conspiracies going on here. Absalom against his dad, David, and then that creates an opportunity potentially in Mephibosheth's mind that he could potentially bring the kingdom back to Saul, because the tribe of Benjamin, at least the tribe that Saul was from, would maybe be open-minded to that. So we'll go kind of one chunk at a time, the first chunk being this first six verses of chapter 15, verses 1 through 6. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now, he's been in Jerusalem. Remember, David brought him back to Jerusalem at the end of chapter 14. And he's been in Jerusalem. He was there for 2 years before David even, by the urging of Joab, David brought him into his company, and they saw each other. But then, you know, he went back to his place and they really didn't have any kind of relationship at all. So that's what the first words after this is about. Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate into the city. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" When he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there's no man designated by the king to hear you." And we talked last week when Absalom was setting this up that there was a hierarchy of, we call them judges, but they were tribal leaders in essence in Jerusalem, the 12 tribes of Jacob. And there were tribal leaders that would hear cases, and then the difficult cases would go to David. But Absalom is saying, there should be somebody that's easier for you to get to. And if I were king, I would hear your case and judge rightly. You know, and obviously the intention is I would judge in your favor, because he's wanting to get these people to come to him. So, pardon? Sucking them in, yeah. Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land, and every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice," in verse 4. "And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him." So Absalom would, you know, would gain their confidence and their friendship and show them some love and admiration and stuff like that. And being, you know, the son of the king, the heir apparent, the people liked that. And he began to draw the people away from David. So verse 6, "Thus Absalom did all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the people." And this was an intentional designed to draw the kingdom away from David, so at the appropriate time, he could go and make his move for the kingdom. At the end of 4 years, now depending on your translation, it might say 40 years. So let's talk about that. The Septuagint version of the Bible, the Greek Old Testament, and a few others, the Peshitta, and that's a local translation for a group around Jerusalem, and the Syriac, all have 40 years. So it would read, "At the end of 40 years, Absalom said to the king." And then there's others that say 4 years. So how do you reconcile that? Well, if your Bible reads 4 years, then the scholars think that after 4 years of him being outcast from David, those 2 years plus 2 years standing at the gate, you know, getting the favor of people, or it might just be 4 years standing at the gate, but it's hard for me to, that it'd be hard for me to see that he would do that for 4 years, maybe 2 years plus the couple of years that he's been estranged while he's in Jerusalem. And then the 40 years might be from a significant event in David's life. Like, remember when he first was inaugurated king, he was in Hebron, and he was there 6.5 years, and then he went to Jerusalem. So if the translation is following 40 years, it's probably 40 years from the time he was inaugurated king, because he served as king for about 40 years, and that would indicate this is getting close to the end of his time as king and close to the end of his life. But I favor the four-year reading. But that's a way to explain it when people say, "See, there's contradictions in the Bible. You just can't trust it." And it just depends. You know, if it's 40 years, it's obviously Absalom didn't stay outside the city gate of Jerusalem for 40 years trying to win the people's heart, because that, you know, that's not possible. So you just have to try to understand what they were writing from, some other significant time in David's life when he became king. So we'll just read it. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. Let me go to Hebron." Well, Hebron was the center of where David started as king. And it would be easy for him to go back there and try and reestablish the kingdom there, rather than try to take over right directly in Jerusalem. Absalom, yeah, he was. That was his hometown. Yeah. "For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur in Aram." Remember the few years he spent after he killed Amnon? He went to live with his grandfather by Geshur. And he's telling David, "I vowed a vow that I would go back and make this sacrifice," or whatever. So he's telling David, "I would like to go do that." And as Cheryl pointed out, that's the town he was born in when David was king there. "For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord indeed will bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord.'" And he did come back to Jerusalem, and he was there for a couple of years. So he's saying, okay, the Lord did what I asked him, so I have to go pay that vow. The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he rose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say Absalom is king at Hebron." So he's gone to Hebron. He's set up, a bunch of followers, and it approaches 600 people before this is all over. A couple of hundred, and then a few more will come and worship with him. So he goes there, and then he says, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say Absalom is king at Hebron." So with Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. They did not know that this is what Absalom had in mind. They just thought they were going with him because he vowed a vow, and they didn't know, because this is all-out war. You know, they don't settle things at the ballot box like we do. It's war. It's people get killed in this kind of thing. So they went in innocence, not knowing Absalom's plan. And yeah, exactly. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Ahithophel was David's counselor. Next statement. He called for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, Gilo. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. So Ahithophel was drawn into that, and he was one of David's close advisors and counselors. So he got drawn into that conspiracy with Absalom. So now some of David's people are turning against him, some of the top.
How old is he now, David?
Well, if it's close to the end of his reign, he's getting close to 70.
Okay.
I don't know how close this is to the end of his reign, but the events that play out for the rest of this book of 2 Samuel make it appear like it's pretty close. We may be the last couple of years of his reign, and he reigned till he was 70 years old. Started when he was about 30, reigned for 40 years till he was about 70-ish. So he could be, you know, younger than I am now.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's interesting because David really trusted
Ahithophel. Yeah.
And it's just like today, how many people did Trump trust?
Bill Barr.
And
his first administration. Mike Pence. So what we're seeing in part here is the rise of the deep state in Israel. Because it is. It's a conspiracy to overthrow the government by people in his family and cabinet that he trusts. So, you know, that's almost the definition of a deep state. When your trusted advisors, people that you trust and put your confidence in, turn against you with a contrary direction for the government to go, that's what we're seeing here. The rise of the deep state. And this deep state is still going on in Israel today, just like it does in every other country. So a messenger came to David, verse 13, and said, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." So David said to all of his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us and quickly bring down ruin on us and strike the city." So David's concern here, the reason he chose to leave Jerusalem right away, is because Jerusalem is not a favorable place to do war. Too many innocent people are going to get killed, collateral damage. They're not, all the people that live in Jerusalem are not warriors. And so David says, if this many people have gone with Absalom and even some of my trusted advisors like Ahithophel, then we need to go outside the city so where we'll be in a place where we can legitimately have a war. Because he recognizes this, what's going to happen, because he is a warrior at heart. Not necessarily when he was a young person, but he had to defend the sheep, you know, against the bear and the lion, he said. And then Goliath, and so his warrior heart was put in place, and he still has that, even though he may be 67, 68 years old. And so David was actually convinced of the hopelessness. Remember what we read about Absalom? He was beautiful. He was strong. There was nobody like him in all the land. And now he's got a couple hundred young soldiers. It's been a phenomenon for me to watch as I age. My church does also. It's the strangest thing. All the people in the church are getting older. Yes. No. And, you know, what happened to all the young people in church that used to be there 30 years ago? Crazy. You know, but this is what happening. This is what's happening to David's army. You know, Joab is not the young man he used to be, and he doesn't swing the sword, and David doesn't unleash the slingshot like he used to. They're still capable men, but a capable 68-year-old man is different than a capable 40-year-old man. It's just different. That's the way it works. And so David is looking at potentially the hopelessness of his cause, and his heart is for the people of the city. Let's get out of Dodge, because people are going to get killed in the next couple of months or weeks, whatever it takes. And we don't need the city of Jerusalem to be decimated like this. So picking it up there in about verse 14, David said to his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us and quickly bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." So they're ready, and they start packing out, and it gives a list of all of the people who are going out with him and the way that they go out through and out of the gates and down the valley and up the hill and different places and the people. I find it interesting, verse 18, "And all his servants passed by him, and all the Keratites and all the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before." So we're talking about a lot of people. And the Gittites from Gath, remember who else was from Gath?
Goliath.
Yeah. That's Goliath's hometown. But now he's got a bunch of the warriors from the hometown of Goliath going with him. And he went back to Gath. He was there for a while. Remember, that's when he made friends with the king in Gath, and he was going to go to war. And then all the other Philistine kings said, David ain't coming, because he'll turn his on us and slaughter all of us. But so many of the people from the city of Goliath are following hard after David now and being his warrior. So
that many people on a, you think, a dirt road, right?
Path.
It's kind of like what we saw with the migrants coming in. Yeah. You know, the thousands of people. That would be close to 1,000.
It is. Yeah, it's a lot of people. So the king said to Ittai, the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday," not meaning yesterday, but, you know, a short time ago. "And shall I today make you wander about with us, since I go, I don't know where, I don't know where I'm going. I'm just getting out of Dodge before Absalom gets here. So go back and take your brothers with you. May the Lord show steadfast love and faith. But Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives. And notice uppercase letters. This Philistine, essentially, the guy from the Gittite, is using the covenant name of God. As the Lord lives, and as my Lord the King lives, wherever my Lord the King shall be, whether death or life, there also will your servant be. Wow, that's amazing. So David's got himself some pretty loyal people. I'm not sure Absalom has that. I think the people Absalom have want him to be king so they can get some kind of secretary position, you know, not secretary like taking notes at the business meeting, but secretary like Tulsi and those kinds of people. They're looking for positions of power also. But the Gittites are looking, look, we're going to fight with you. If we die, we die. But we're dying with you, if that's the way it turns. So they all went out. And in verse 24, starting a new section here, that kind of finishes in verse 23 when all of them go out into the wilderness and get ready for their banishment in the wilderness. And in verse 24, Abiathar came up, and behold, Abiathar's a priest, and Zadok came also with all the Levites, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God until the people had all passed out of the city. And the king said to Zadok, carry the Ark of God back into the city, because Jerusalem is the city that God chose for himself. The Ark has no business leaving that city. This is up to God. David is thinking, the battle belongs to the Lord. If I win, I'll go back and the Ark will be there. But if I lose, it's gone. The Ark belongs in Jerusalem. And again, he's thinking of Jerusalem rather than himself. And he's not looking at the Ark as though it's some kind of, you know, good luck charm that's going to win the battle for him. Yeah, so he tells them to carry the Ark of God back into the city, verse 25. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me back and let me see both it and his dwelling place. But if it says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him to do to me what seems good to him. So the king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer, a prophet? Are you not one that can see the plan of God? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz, your son, and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar, the other priest. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. But David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered, showing there barefoot and with his head covered, demonstrating his mourning for having to leave the city under these kinds of circumstances. In other words, not being a proud warrior going out, being humiliated and wanting to see what is the plan and purpose of God in this, because he's definitely not going out like the king of Israel. He's just going out recognizing the humiliation of what's befallen the people of God. So all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. When it was told to David that Ahithophel was among the conspirators with Absalom, David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness, which was a very good idea for David to do that. You know, he recognizes that some of his own people have turned against him, and he probably knows why. You know, that whole thing with Bathsheba and Uriah, and
he was warned.
And he was warned. That, you know, that brought a lot of shame on everybody when the king does something like that. You know, you can think of Bill Clinton, you can think of whatever, you know, there's anytime you see that man or his wife, you can't get away from the shame of who they are. And they brought it on themselves, as did David. And so he says, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped on Mount of Olives, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his cloak torn and dirt on his head. And David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I'll be your servant. So then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. So David is sending his deep state alliance into Absalom's deep state alliance. And he's telling him, go and make peace with Absalom and say to him, as I served your father, the king, so I will serve you as king, and gaining the favor. And he wants him to confound the wisdom of Ahithophel, who has turned against David when he learned that Ahithophel went. So he's sending Hushai back to Jerusalem so that he can confound him. So if you return to the city and say to Absalom, verse 34, I will be like your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I'll be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Because Absalom is going to trust Ahithophel, because he sees Ahithophel has willingly turned against David and now is advising how to get David, how to overcome him. Hushai, he says, is just going to appear like, well, he's one of David's cabinet members, and he recognizes that David is not going to be king, so he's just going to stick with the new king, just going from one administration to the next, kind of like most of the bureaucrats in D.C. do. Whoever comes in as the next president, you know, they serve that one. Supposed to. That's the way it's supposed to work. So this is what he's setting up Hushai to do. If you go with me, you'll be a burden, but otherwise you can be beneficial to me to confound the plans of Ahithophel. And then he says to him in verse 35, are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, you're going to, and David is already calling Absalom king, but he's more or less referring to the palace because he knows Absalom will take the palace. Whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar and their two sons, Ahimaaz and Zadok's son and Jonathan. By them you shall send to me everything you hear. So David's friend Hushai came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. And so now the stage is set. As we get to this point in the story, the lines have been drawn. David is going to draw them outside of the city so that the population of the city remains free of war. He's going to draw Absalom out of the city, and he's also going to put at least three of his confidants, Zadok and the Abiathar, as the priests, with the, and because they're staying there with the Ark of the Covenant, Absalom will tend to trust them. They won't be in his confidential circle because they're the priests. He's the king. There's a separation of powers there designed by God. And so they're going to be trusted, but they're not going to be the inner circle like Ahithophel and Hushai will be in the inner circle. So the stage is getting set for that conflict as it begins. And you have Absalom, a young man who's been driven for most all of his life now, since the rape of his sister. He has been driven to take the kingdom. And when his relationship with his father went sour because he chose to murder his brother, which nobody blames him for doing that because his brother raped his sister. So then he understands he's probably going to have to take the kingdom by force. And so he's been setting himself up to do this. He lived with his grandfather. David brought him back through Joab by the story that woman told last week in chapter 14. And he came back into Jerusalem, but he still didn't have any relationship with his dad. And then he spent a couple of years at the gate, you know, a couple of years just brewing and stewing, and a couple of years at the gate, drawing the heart of the people toward him, building himself up in the opinion of the people. And now he's gone to Hebron. He's declared himself king, and he's coming back to Jerusalem. And he arrives back to Jerusalem at the same time that Hushai is coming back into town under David's direction. So the stage is set for the battles to begin. We have a little bit of time. We can go on into chapter 16. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth. Now, do you remember the story of when Mephibosheth was brought to David? Ziba was a servant of Saul. And And he's the one that told David that Mephibosheth still lived. And David said, bring him to me. I want to show him the kindness because he's descended from Saul. David has always, you know, he hasn't always been Saul's best friend, but he's never really been his enemy either. And his relationship with Jonathan. And so when David passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, and 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, why have you brought these? He answered, well, the donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink. And so it was really a very generous offering of Ziba to do this for David. He manages Saul's property under the ownership now of Mephibosheth, but Ziba's still in charge of all the property because Mephibosheth is in the palace with David and crippled. Yes. And the king said, and where's your master's son? Ziba said to the king, behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father. Now, I wonder if Mephibosheth really said that, or if Ziba is saying that to turn David's heart against Mephibosheth, because what is the next thing David does? So the king said to Ziba, behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. And Ziba said, I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king. So in that stroke, David gave him all of the property that was Saul's, that would have gone to Jonathan, that now has been Mephibosheth's, and Ziba has been the caretaker of it now for 30 years, 20-some years, 25, 30 years. And so now the king says, okay, it's all yours. If Mephibosheth is going to turn on me and try to get the kingdom back under his leadership to the family of Saul, because as I mentioned at the beginning, at least the tribe of Benjamin would probably go along with that, because that's the tribe that Saul came from. None of them care, the ones that know, none of them care that God said, I'm taking the kingdom away from Saul and giving it to David. That doesn't matter to them. They didn't have that little bumper sticker that said, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. You know, and I took that middle statement. It doesn't matter if you believe it or not, God said it, that settles it. Period. But they don't care. You know, I know that's been 30 years though, so now it's time to come back to the house of Saul, because they want the king from their own tribe. So whether Mephibosheth really said that, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But there's too much of people seeking their own benefit in this whole thing. And that's exactly what God tells the people they shouldn't be doing from the very beginning with Adam and Eve. Don't just seek your own will and what you think is best for you. Ask me first, you know. And then he's taken a few thousand years to write the directions down, so we don't have to ask him about every little thing. All we have to do is look up the address in the Bible. It's in this book, this chapter, this verse. Do that. And so God was gracious enough to give us his word so that we can know how to govern our lives. So David ends up stripping Mephibosheth of all of the pension that he had given him earlier, the pension of Saul's property managed by Ziba, and he bequeathed that he gave it all to Ziba. Verse 5. When King David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, and as he came out, he cursed continually, because he had a grudge against Saul, because Saul took the kingdom from, or he had a grudge against David, excuse me, because in his eyes, David took the kingdom away from Saul and slaughtered him, when we all know that's not true. That is not the way it happened. David steadfastly refused to harm Saul at all, nor did he harm any of Saul's family. That was all done by the Philistines and others, but here Shimei flames it all on David, and he threw stones at David, and all the servants of the king David, and all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. So he was standing there throwing rocks at all of David's followers and David himself. And Shimei said as he cursed, get you man of blood, you worthless man.
It's just a peaceful protester.
Yeah, there you go. He was a peaceful protester, mostly peaceful. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. In whose place you have reigned after God took it away from Saul and gave it by the word of Samuel. I mean, everybody respected the word of Samuel until now. And given the kingdom of in the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. And then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to King, why should this dead dog curse my lord, the king? Let me go over and whack his head off. Which was, you know, the national recourse in that culture. You know, you didn't just go over and beat him up. You know, you just cut his head off. That'll fix it. But the king said, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? You sons of Zeruiah, remember that's Joab and this guy, Abishai, their brothers. And what have I do to you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he's cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. And I don't know if the Lord really told him to, but that's what David said. David sees that, you know, and he may be doing some reflection. Boy, I wished I would have disciplined Amnon when he raped his sister. Boy, I wished I would have gone to war instead of standing on the porch looking at my neighbor's wife.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he has a lot of regrets that he knows because he wrote Psalm 51. He knows he's been forgiven, but he also knows that oftentimes the consequences are pretty hard for that grievous of a sin. You know, adultery, murder, not disciplining your kids when they rape their sisters, not disciplining your kids when they murder their brothers. That, you know, those are grievous sins. That's much more than playing devil on the doorstep, you know. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, verse 12, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men went on the road while Shimei went out along the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan. That'd be the Jordan River, you know, south of Jerusalem and moving east. And they arrived there weary, and there he refreshed himself. So that's quite a hike for them to have taken on short notice with a lot of people. And he's going barefoot, and he's emotionally distressed. And it's an exhausting time for him. And the responsibility of all those people, where are you going to find food? I mean, you know, people have to have food. They're not like Jesus. They can't just make five loaves and feed 5,000 people. But God provides for them through Ziba and through others. And so they're at the Jordan River. They're exhausted. They're refreshing themselves. They're eating some of the food Ziba gave them, although it's not enough for everybody. Others are finding something else, and maybe they packed a lunch before they left. Who knows? But now it's nighttime.
Killing scorpions.
Probably night. And they're coming in to Jordan and exhausted. And we don't have time to get into verse 15 and that whole story there, because there's a lot that we need to talk about in those verses. So we'll stop there. But here we see, going through chapter 15 and half of chapter 16 at this point, that Absalom has mounted his assault against his dad. It's his intention to become king by force. He knows it's not going to happen any other way. And he's going to have to see the death of his father in order for him to be king. He understands that. He said, David is not going to give this up, and I'm not going to take it unless David's dead. And so he knows full well, when he left Jerusalem to go to Hebron, he knew full well that in the coming week or weeks, he was going to be the cause of his own father's death. And he will be the new king in Jerusalem of Israel. That's his plan. And so now we see that David, in his attempt to hang on to the kingdom, should it be God's will, that he's taken appropriate soldiers with him, releasing the others to stay in Jerusalem, and taking those who can assist him in the upcoming battle. But think of emotionally, the exhaustion he's going through. Oftentimes when I've had the opportunity either to officiate at weddings or funerals, I guard the people, either the groom and the bride or the family of the lost one. I guard them against too much celebration. You don't want that big of a wedding. You don't want that big of a party at the funeral or whatever, because it's an extremely emotional day. And you don't need the other stuff attending that. The emotion of that event is enough. And so here he is, you know, his son has chased him out of town, has the intent to kill him, but he also has the responsibility of all these people. And while he's marching and people throwing rocks at him and other people, he's trying to formulate a battle plan against his own son, plus protect the people that are going with him. And so it's just, you can't even imagine the emotional struggles that he's going through and the spiritual perseverance to get through this, Cheryl.
And they say that Psalm 3 was David had written about
this event with Absalom. Yeah.
So
while he's marching out to Jerusalem, and with addition, all that other stuff, he's also writing the book of Psalms. In text to talk, in his iPad, iPhone, or whatever. So, yeah. So that's where we'll finish it tonight, and then God willing, carry on next week, chapter 16 and verse wherever we left off. Chapter 16, verse 15.
Excellent.
Father, we thank you for the day that you've given us again, Father, and thank you for this word, and thank you for men like David who, even they have these significant failures in their life, yet they still learn to trust you and to make different decisions and perhaps better ones. Thank you for his heart for the people of Jerusalem and trying to protect them. Thank you for his heart for the Ark of the Covenant, sending it back to the tabernacle and the place it was housed to protect it. And thank you for the example that he stands to us as a man whose heart was fast after God. Help us, Lord, to see in this how these same plans just seem to tumble down the corridors of history and repeat over and over and over again. Give us wisdom, Father, for the days we live in, and wisdom for those of our leaders who would give some resemblance to pursuing hard after you. Thank you, Father, in Christ's name. Amen.